Hello there, I'm Rafael Di Furia, back at it again for another episode of Not Your Average Globetrotter. This week, I wanted to introduce you guys to someone who I recently had the pleasure of meeting. Somebody who I really feel as though actually embodies what it means to be not your average Globetrotter, and somebody who's been through the ups and downs having left their own home country at the age of 16. Yes, alone at 16 on the other side of the world from family. And this person has definitely had what I would call a successful transition into a life abroad. And rather than my talking too much about Amir, I am going to let Amir tell you about Amir. Roll that intro. Mr. Amir Ganat, thank you so much for coming to join me on this episode of Not Your Average Globetrotter. Welcome.
Absolutely my pleasure, Rafael. I've been watching your shows and I am really, really glad to be here.
You know, Amir, we've been talking a bit recently. We met at a networking event here in Braga. Also, you are a coach and you work in the leadership space, and maybe we'll get to that a little bit later. Yeah. But hearing about your story and about you, getting to know you a little bit, just in the few minutes that we've actually spent together, I was thinking, okay, this guy has to be on Not Your Average Globetrotter, because he definitely fits into the Not Your Average Globetrotter side. So let's start from the beginning, because you originally were born in Tehran, or?
Yes.
Yeah. And then you went to America at 16.
Yes.
That is, in and of itself, quite amazing, but you did this alone.
That is correct.
Before we get into maybe the full story, to just say that you had come from another country and lived, quote unquote, the American dream, made a life for yourself, a wife, children, you've been around the world, but to start out, 16-year-old Amir coming to America for the first time. What was that for you? How did that feel to come to this new country on the other side of the world?
Yeah, you know, it was quite an adventure. I didn't realize what I was getting into, honestly, until like the moment before I got on the plane, right? Mm-hmm. Because my parents decided, this was 1978, and there was a revolution was brewing and so on and so forth. My parents decided that it would be best for me to get out of the country, get my education, and come back. Now, as it turned out, I didn't get back to Iran for 13 years.
Wow.
But, you know, being a kid, I thought, hey, you know, yeah, I'll go. And then it was just a few minutes before I got on the plane. It was like, oh, crap, I'm going somewhere where I don't speak the language. I don't know anybody. I don't have a lot of money. I don't have any resources. It was just, it just like really hit me. I remember sobbing on the plane. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I'm 16 years old. I look like I'm 12. I've led a fairly sheltered life. And, but anyway, I'm on the plane. I'm going to Boston, Massachusetts, and all I have is the address to a high school.
Mm-hmm.
And so I get there. It's fairly early in the morning, I get out of the airport, hand this piece of paper to a taxi driver, and he takes me to the school, and he drops me off, and I'm knocking on the door, and nobody's coming. And making things worse was it was raining, like there's no tomorrow. Oh. And so finally a policeman comes over and says, basically helps me understand that the school is not opening. So he takes me to a hotel. I get a hotel room, come back the next day and go to a high school, and sort of they put me up in a dorm and so on and so forth. But to tell you what it was all about, but I have to tell you, I would wake up every day homesick, feeling like, geez, what the heck did I do to myself? It was really, really tough. Mm-hmm. But this was also, and there were a lot of other things that happened, which I'm happy to get into, but at the end of the day, what my survival came down to was that I had heard a lot of stories about kids in my situation who had left and didn't make it. Mm-hmm. It was tough for them. They would end up going back and so on. And I was just absolutely determined that no matter what, I'm going to make it. So I had a series of other challenges, but, you know, managed through it. And I should say, I want to also be very clear, I'm not claiming that I have really accomplished a lot. There were so many people who had it worse than me, you know, and there's so many immigrants, no countless Iranians who have accomplished a whole lot more than I have. But, you know, when people hear my story, they always go like, oh, geez, I can't believe you made it through all of that.
Well, it's funny, actually, that you should mention Boston. Right next to you, there's a little stand that's Boston Light, and my grandfather in the picture was the keeper of the light. It's funny, that Boston connection there. So coming to America, because this is revolution brewing, your family's concerned about, I'm sure, your future. Was this something that they decided they wanted for you and said, you should do this? Or was it like they gave you the option to stay or go?
Yeah, you know, our family was very much, progressive family where we talked about things. My mother was always very open with us, my dad as well, and got us involved in conversations. So it wasn't something that I was forced to do, but I have to say that I respected their opinions. And they were like, look, universities are closing and all that. Why don't you just go and get your education? The idea was, you know, you come back every year and then you wait until this thing blows over and then you come back. And of course, there was a revolution, there was war, and it didn't turn out like that. But I always tell people, you know, there were a lot of challenges I had to overcome. And when people hear about that, they're like, wow, geez, you know, you must have, been really strong to make it through that. But bottom line is, look, you deal with whatever's in front of you, okay? Right. I really believe that we all have it in us to deal with whatever's in front of us. But the real heroes of my story are my parents. Mm. Okay, because they chose to go ahead and make this happen for me at a time when, you know, they didn't really have the financial means. They were worried about me. I mean, let's face it, at that time, there was no WhatsApp and FaceTime and all of that. And the way I communicated with my parents was every 2 weeks, I would get a roll of quarters and I would go to a payphone and I would put this roll of quarters, $10, and I would get 3 minutes.
No way.
Essentially, yeah, absolutely. And in those 3 minutes, it's like, okay, I'm still alive. Everything's okay. How are you guys doing? And then so 2 weeks later, that was our appointment, right?
Yeah.
And so in the meantime, I mean, I'm sure they were worried sick about me. So they had the courage to go with an option that was really best for me, even though it was probably not the most comfortable for them.
That's amazing. I mean, this is also one of the reasons why I wanted to bring you on, is because in some ways I can relate to some of what you said, because I left the US at 17 and went through, I mean, this is a very close time. And so like, I'm sure you had things, because this is also a different time, a different era in the States, maybe some people being less open to people from other countries, whatever. We don't need to get into that at this moment, but I can see what kind of struggles there would have been. Even when I first left, I also had that type of situation. It wasn't a roll of quarters, but it was a card that you would put into the payphone to be able to call. And thankfully, it wasn't $10 for 3 minutes, but I can definitely relate, because I used to go to stand outside for like a half an hour in the freezing cold or in the rain, whatever it was, to be able to call back to the States.
Absolutely.
But wow. So for you, though, settling in to get into the swing of things, learning the language, how long do you feel as though it really took you to get to that point where it was feeling like home and it was feeling like a place that you were comfortable, at least to some extent?
Yeah. So feeling like home took quite a while, and I'll tell you about that. But getting a hang of the language, to some extent, it was just like, you know, baptism by fire, if you will. You're thrown in the, you just got to make it, right?
Right.
And so, to be honest, I had a few years of English in Iran, so I knew some words and phrases and so on, but conversational skills were non-existent, right? I could not carry on a conversation. But I had finished 11th grade in Iran, and I went through 3 months of language school in Boston. And then in the remaining 3 months, the 6 months that I was in Boston, in 3 months, I finished 12th grade, because I had already had all of that stuff. In fact, I had the first 2 years of college, physics and math and all of that, by the time I finished 11th grade in Iran.
Wow.
So I was able to breeze through college in about 3 years. I graduated when I was 20, just turned 20. But as far as the language is concerned, I think at the end of the 6 months, I was able to definitely have a conversation and all of that. The tricky thing about it is that this was Boston, Massachusetts, and then I ended up going to college in Cochran, Georgia, which is a very small town south of Atlanta. And I remember saying to my, you know, I wanted to go to an engineering school, and the principal said, look, that's the school right there. It's warmer, it's cheaper, and it's closer to Georgia Tech, which is where I eventually ended up at. So I got on the Greyhound bus, and 33 hours later, and, you know, 33 hours and a backache later, if you will, I get off in downtown, if you could call it that. It was just a very small town, village, if you will, Cochran, Georgia, right? And now people are talking to me, and I no longer understand what they're saying. I thought maybe I fell asleep and the bus went to Mexico. So I had to learn English all over again.
It's right? Funny because
different accent.
My grandparents went through the same thing because they're from Boston.
Yeah.
And of course, Boston, they've got their way of speaking. They've got their accent. They've got their dialect.
Yeah.
And then my grandmother, they went to be in a children's home, to work in a children's home there. And they couldn't understand anybody. Even there's this old story my grandmother used to say all the time, just the difference that she experienced, that she was so shocked by, because she came from a prim proper era where things were a certain way.
Yeah.
And there were these boys that or there was a boy that ran into the house, and she said, Miss D, my grandmother, Miss D Furia, Miss D, they's fatten. She's like, what did you just say?
they's fatten.
But She didn't understand, and she thought that this little boy was coming in and saying, they're farting.
Yeah, it's quite different, but I have to tell you, like yesterday, I never take these quizzes on Facebook, but yesterday there was one that intrigued and challenged me, and it was one of these things where you say, okay, you're a true Southerner if you can answer these questions, and there were like 50 slangs,
right,
and I answered all of them, and I got a 100% right, so for a boy who grew up in Iran, I did really great, but I have to tell you, you know, when I was in Cochran, that's 1979 when they took the hostages in Iran. So there was a lot of unrest there, in that there were about 35 Iranian students. In fact, I met my friends that I called my brothers from other mothers. There's like 14 of us who met in 1979, and we went through a lot of stuff together, if you will. And the town people were very upset, obviously, about what was going on in Iran. So they assumed that we were supporting that sort of thing. And there were all kinds of incidents, you know. And one night, it was like a lynching, essentially planned. And I remember being in this dorm and looking all around, you know, these glass windows, people with pitchforks, you know, baseball bats, shotguns, demanding that the school turn the Iranian students over. And so somehow we survived that and many other incidents. But to your question around when did I feel at home, I certainly didn't feel at home at that time, right? We had a circle of friends.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until, I would say, to answer that part of your question, it wasn't until I met my wife when I was 18, actually. And about a year later, we got married. Wow. So we met at Six Flags. I had a summer job at Six Flags where I was sleeping in the car and, you know, taking showers at Six Flags and all of this. But anyway, I met my wife, Connie, that you've met, who you've met.
Very sweet woman.
Thank you. And so when we got married, basically about a year later, I was 19 years old. And then I really felt at home. Her family really welcomed me with open arms. And I just felt like, you know, I'm home.
That's so awesome. I mean, especially so young. Okay, coming to a whole new country, learning the language, going through high school, getting through college, lynching, then all of a sudden this wonderful woman shows up in your life.
That's right.
That you build this life together. So, I mean, I can see how that would be the point where it would start feeling like home, because you're making a home. You're not giving yourself another option. Then also you said to me the other day when we had a conversation that you weren't actually able to go back to Iran for many years. So was that something that you knew upfront very early on? Or was that something that, okay, I have to wait more time and more time and more time because of what's happening?
Well, it was just unfolding a little bit at a time. So we weren't really sure. So it was just always, yeah, it's right around the corner. Maybe I can go visit. But in Iran, all the males over 18 who are not in school have to do military service. Right. And so if I had gone home, I would have been drafted essentially into the military and had to go to war. And so it ended up being 13 years, and it wasn't until 1991, when our kids were 2 and 3 years old, that Connie and the kids and I went for the first time. Wow. I was able to, they established this thing where you could buy your way out of the military and say, okay, I pay this kind of
I've heard about that.
Money, and basically I get my exemption. And so we were able to go, and it was a fantastic time seeing the family again
so after that, 13 years. For grandparents especially, that must have been amazing. Yeah. They sent their kid off as a kid. He's coming back as a married man with family, everything.
How did
they ever tell you how that was for them to see that?
Oh, it was amazing. I mean, you know, of course, there were a lot of words, but the just seeing them, I mean, just the pictures that I've seen that always remind me once again of those times that we had together. And since then, we've been back many, many times. And I'm so glad that my kids had a chance to sort of understand that part of their heritage. Mm-hmm. And so it was just a wonderful feeling for them and for us.
That's so awesome. I mean, I can say also as like the child of an immigrant and then third generation down on the other side, I would agree with you, having a connection with your roots, it's paramount. To understand who you are, maybe even certain like little things that you do and you don't know why you do it.
Yeah.
Sometimes maybe even certain tastes that you have will start making sense just because it has to do something with your genes, the place that formed your family.
Yeah.
But for your children now, how is that for them? And also to an extent yourself, for your personal identity, because you've been so far removed by years, do you feel a sense more of being American or more of being Iranian or a man who's here on this planet, on enjoying this this round around the sun?
That's a great question. There's a part of me that really relates to myself as sort of as an American. You know, there are a lot of topics that I never even explored or dealt with when I was 16 years old.
And so
most of my adult life, I've lived in the U.S. and eventually, you know, Thailand and Germany, other places, but sort of in that world. But then there's a part of me that relates every time we go back to Iran. And of course, Iran is a different place now as well than the Iran that prior to revolution that I grew up in. But to your point, there are a lot of those sights and smells and senses and all this that kind of stick with you. Yeah. And my kids have a good sense for that. In fact, here in Portugal, one of the things that I often hear from my kids is some of the parallels that they see. Because I always say, you know, I'm kind of like a coin that has two sides, right? Okay, so that's the Iranian side, that's the American side. When I go to the U.S., I flip over that side, or when I'm dealing with Americans or whatever, it's like, okay, the American side, it fits right in and whatever. When I go over there to Iran, I flip over to the other side and I blend right in.
Yeah.
But actually coming to Portugal, what I've experienced is that a bit of both. It feels like, okay, I finally arrived somewhere where I get to sort of enjoy some of the conveniences and comforts and all of this of the Western world, if you will. But also in many ways, this culture and the way things are kind of remind me of Iran. Yeah. And my kids have mentioned some things like that. Oh, geez, that looks just like Iran.
So we
feel right at home here.
That's interesting. I mean, even like I've also lived in the Middle East, and like there I can relate to that understanding of like, okay, there's certain parts of me that definitely like I got shaped by that time there and living in that part of the world and certain sights and smells. I mean, hell, what's that in English? Cardamom.
Yeah. Cardamom. Hell, cardamom. We call it hell as well in Farsi. Yeah.
Like, and to have that in tea, it's like just to have some of these flavors that you don't necessarily experience in the West, but then in Portugal, you have And I can totally get what you're saying about even looking at a certain place. Oh, this looks like a certain other area. Yeah. I've even seen areas here just like close to within a block of where we are right now.
Yeah.
That I'm like, okay, this I definitely looks like someplace that I've seen in the Middle East before. the stones on the outside of the building, whatever. But
yeah.
As well, also, because it's been like really fascinating to hear about this connection. And mm-hmm. then also this development that you had for yourself, and we've only, I'm sure, just barely scratched the surface, but you also led into a professional career in the States and built up a life for yourself. And so how was that to come into university, finding yourself in this other part of the world where now you're becoming an adult and really need to make something happen because you do have that wife and children that need to be supported?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I grew up with the mentality in the U.S. that I always had to have a plan A, B, C, D, and E. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how many odd jobs I've done and, mm-hmm. you know, and all this just to make sure that I always have a backup plan. But one of the values that my parents had sort of instilled in me is like, look, you stay in school, you finish school. So I got my bachelor's in mechanical engineering and graduated at the time when the job market wasn't all that great. I was a waiter at a restaurant. I was making more money than my engineer friends. I couldn't find a job anyway. So I decided I went back to the school, really? Georgia Tech, and I got my master's in mechanical engineering and started with Procter & Gamble and in a manufacturing plant. Very soon after that, I recognized that I had gotten into engineering simply because that was the thing to do in Iran. You know, my uncles were engineers and so on and so forth. But I gravitated a lot toward the organizational side of things, you know, sort of empowering people, energizing people, getting in their world and making sure that they are effective. So before I read any leadership books, I just inherently knew that my job as a manager, if you will, was not to tell people what to do, but to be there to bust barriers for them and things like that. So I excelled at that. So I stayed in my career for 31 years in manufacturing and supply chain, had various leadership roles, but I always, whether I was a maintenance manager or I was a plant manager, I always did it from an angle of energizing the organization and making sure that they are showing up as the most powerful version of themselves. And so then later on, I got my MBA and so on and so forth. So my career sort of evolved. Even though I was doing technical jobs, I was always doing it from this approach of organizational development. And then that led to, you know, essentially going into this line of work full time.
You know, while we're on this topic, I mean, of course, I have to mention on camera that this is not sponsored in any way, but I just wanted to invite Amir here just because we've become friends very quickly, I feel. And to have this conversation, I felt, like I said, was really worthwhile having here on Not Your Average Globetrotter. But maybe if you can just quickly, before we get into more about like your global travels and living around, maybe just quickly about the work that you do and then also about your book as well.
Sure. So I'll tell you the short version of a long story. In 2015, my daughter finally got fed up with me saying, I'm going to publish a book someday, right? And she said, look, that's just counter to everything you preach. You need to do this now. Because I had thousands of notes and voice notes and things like that. So she took over the project and basically started making this book happen. And she gave me assignments. And so we published the book, The Transformative Leader, in 2015. Then she started getting on my case to quit my job so we can go into business together and expand our reach. Mm-hmm. So I missed her deadline just by a few months, but I eventually left my corporate career. And we started the Ganad Group, where we guide leaders in creating extraordinary cultures that deliver breakthrough results and unprecedented fulfillment. Right. So that's what we do. I mean, I do keynote speeches, I do coaching, consulting, workshops, a variety of services, all aimed at organizations creating cultures that are really good for their people and their shareholders. And so then eventually my wife and my son joined as well. And so that's the work that we do. And we absolutely love it.
That's so awesome that you guys get to have this family event. I mean, that you got married so young, that you had children, that you've got this whole life so full together. I mean, really, it's a blessing. And I so respect that you guys have been able to do this. It's a beautiful thing that you don't see often. But I have to say, you mentioned one word twice that I find really interesting that you just happened to say within what you were talking about. That's the word culture. Mm-hmm. Of course, going to another part of the world, that's a different culture, but also within work, how it's all formed together can all have an impact on greater culture around you, but then also the greater culture can have the impact within the work itself. And so you've also had the experience of working in different locations around the world. So do you feel as though that's something that you also bring into your work, and then also vice versa, that having these cultural experiences on the national scale, living day-to-day life, has really impacted the work that you do as well?
Absolutely. I think, you know, I've always been drawn to that sort of thing, partly because of what my mom and dad sort of instilled in me. But so I have this gift and this curse of empathy, like being able to get into people's world and see the world through their eyes. And it's a gift because it really enables me to support them and that sort of thing. But sometimes it's a curse because I end up, you know, basically absorbing all the toxins, right? Because I feel their pain.
Yeah.
But so that being the case, I've always been very much in tune with the nuances of culture, be it the culture in this organization versus that organization, or the culture in this country versus that country. And my experiences working in Thailand, in Germany, having traveled to, I don't know, close to 50 countries and so on and so forth, it has really helped me because I'm always observing, always trying to learn and sort of be in their world. So, so it all has come together.
That's interesting. So out of the, so basically US, Thailand, Iran, not sorry, Thailand, Germany.
Yeah.
These countries that you've worked in, did you feel as though there was one that more aligned with the way that you kind of just naturally happen to live your life or want to work?
There are aspects. You know, I wouldn't say that there's one culture that is really sort of absolutely that I fit in. I say, okay, this, because even within those countries, right, you would see. Even when I was working for Procter & Gamble in Germany, one department had a slightly different culture than another.
Right.
What I have to say, I mean, I probably feel very comfortable, more comfortable with the American culture because I've been more exposed to it. I get to really identify those nuances and go with it. But what happened in Thailand and in Germany was that I was able to really understand some of those other nuances that maybe not clear, not visible to the naked eye, right? So, for example, in Thailand, you don't want to tell people something very directly because they lose face and so on and so forth. It has an adverse effect. It doesn't work to confront somebody, giving them feedback. You want to be a little softer. That doesn't mean you're compromising anything. It just means that you communicate the way they want to be communicated with.
Yeah, you have to know your audience.
Yeah. In Germany, it's absolutely the opposite. If I ever sort of started to beat around the bush just a little bit, they'd be like, oh, you're acting so American. Just go ahead and say it.
I've seen that before. They get so annoyed. It's like, no, just like, come on, get straight to the point already. Like, we don't have time for this.
That's right. So I think it's so important for people to recognize the culture. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to be a different person, but you do need to adapt your communication style. You know, my experience is that, you know, globally, everybody wants the same things. It's just that they don't want it delivered the same way. Like, nobody wants to be kept in the dark and not ever be asked for their input. This is a universal thing. Everybody wants information. They want to have input. But the way you do that is different in Japan, in Thailand, in Iran, in Germany, in the U.S., different parts of the U.S. even.
Yeah.
Right. So you've got to be in tune with the culture and then sort of shape it the way that it serves the people who are living in that culture.
I 1,000,000% agree with all of that. And I'm also curious because you did have these global journeys, but now you find yourself living in Portugal.
Right.
How did all of these dots connect to one another? Was it a natural progression? You were looking online, accidental? I'm very curious about that.
Well, you know, you and I are both third culture kids, right? So this we got a chance to meet the author of this book, Third Culture Kid, as he gave a lecture at one of our kids' schools before he passed away.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, yeah. And it was just, it's a book that we've all read and understood. So in that, you know, one of our characteristics is we can't really sit still. We want to do something different, go somewhere else, right?
Oh, I don't know anybody like that in my life.
That's right. Makes sense. So So for us, you know, in 2004, my wife and I and the kids decided that we were going to go back to the States. We were living in Germany at the time, but we wanted to go to the States before the kids went off to college. And so we made that change. And we went there, the kids went off to college, did their thing, and, you know, all of that. But we always knew that when we retired, we would like to experience something different. We once again want to go international. So this was always on the back burner, sort of at some point we're going to do that. And although I haven't retired, and I always say I have rewired, and I don't plan to retire, we decided that after the pandemic and all that, where we can do all of our work virtually, even though we've started doing some things in person now, we said, look, it's time. We can do this. And so we started looking, and we looked at Costa Rica. We went there a couple of times, loved the vacation, but we decided in the end that wasn't for us. And then we discovered Portugal on YouTube, essentially. And we started doing a lot of research. We had never been here when we applied for our visa.
Really?
We essentially landed here sight unseen, having decided that this is home.
Oh, I love that. I absolutely love that.
I mean, all the traveling that I've done around the world and many, many countries around Europe, I had never been to Portugal.
Uh-huh.
But we decided based on our research that this was the place. And some of our friends were like, geez, that's kind of stupid. What if you don't like it? Well, you know what? We're not a tree. We can move. But turned out that it was a great decision, and we've been here a little over a year now, and we love it.
That's so awesome how you kind of made your way here. Because also, my first time coming to Portugal, no experience. I just know my family, part of my family is Brazilian. Some of our ancestors come from this country. That's about it. I didn't know that there was a difference between Brazilian Portuguese, European Portuguese, and how extremely different that they can be in the cultures also. But for you coming here, getting used to a new country, have there been any challenges that you and your family have faced so far that have been tricky to overcome? Or do you feel as though maybe it's been easier because of your experiences in so many different places in the world?
I would say it has been easier because of our experiences, because it's, to me, it's all a matter of setting your expectations, right? Mm-hmm. Right. You know, if you move someplace with this idea that it's nirvana and everything is amazing, the smallest thing can really trip you up, and it's geez, what did I get myself into? So of course, there have been challenges. It's like in Portugal, as many expats know, a lot of things don't work very quickly, or sometimes there's ambiguity when you're going to change your driver's license, right, or you when you apply, but you can't track it online and all of this. But honestly, it's like we had prepared ourselves for whatever challenges come our way. And in the grand scheme of things, if we look at the overall picture, we're extremely happy to be here. So yes, there are some inconveniences, if you will, based on our conditioning that says, okay, this should work that way, that should work that way. But what I have learned actually in my travels and living in different places is this word should is really not a good word. It's been this way for a long time before you came here.
Yes.
And it's like, okay, you adapt. If you want to improve something, more power to you, go do it. But if not, you're in the system and this is how it works. And yes, some days it's frustrating. Mm-hmm. But in the grand scheme of things, I think, expats ought to be, or immigrants ought to be prepared to go through some level of culture shock, right?
Definitely.
I mean, that's just normal, that some days you're like, oh, geez, what did I get myself into, so on and so forth. It's not the end of the day. Take a deep breath, go for a walk, look at things, look at the facts, not the stories, because, you know, oftentimes we get overwhelmed because something happens and then we turn it into a much scarier sort of picture in our own minds. And I think the last thing I would say is that having a good support base is really, really important. Now, I know here we have, many pioneers who came here 20 years ago didn't have the support base. Now we have all these Facebook pages and all these people. In our case, we have our little family, the four of us. We support each other. When one of us is down, somebody else is pulling them up and things like that. So overall, it has worked out beautifully for us.
That's awesome. Again, like I have to say, it's another beautiful thing that not only you guys can work together, you can be a family together, but you can also move internationally together and enjoy life in a different part of the world and be able to understand that, there's going to be things that are different and that there are things that you have to get used to. And it's funny, I always hear from people who've lived in the States and some other Western countries that like, oh my gosh, things are so slow here. Things are this here, things are that here. But then like I moved here from Italy. I'm like, whoa, things are like lightning speed here sometimes. Like, whoa, there's this is actually like a computerized system. No way. I don't want to talk bad about Italy, but like there's a difference in the way that things, and it's all about perspective and where you're coming from and even to an extent where you're going to. But Amir, I wanted to say a huge thank you, really, for joining.
My pleasure.
It was such a pleasure to have you. I want to have you back on in the future if you
thank you so much. Oh, on. Absolutely. Anytime. Thank you so much for having me. It's been really. Great thank talking you. To you.
It's been fantastic. And just before finishing the episode, of course, if you're interested to find out more about Amir, what he does, and his book, you can go visit thegnadgroup.com. I'll have all of his links to all of his social media down in the more info section below. And of course, a huge thank you to those of you who helped to make these episodes possible through the one-time donations, like the thanks button here on YouTube, as well as the monthly support through Patreon, as well as another thank you to those of you who like and share these episodes and are subscribed on both YouTube as well as the audio-only podcasts. Of course, also, it's always wonderful to hear from you guys and have you guys take part of the conversation in the comment section down below on YouTube. I'm always very interested to hear what you guys have to say because there's always so many thoughtful ideas that are shared down there. But of course, I am Rafael Di Furia. Stay safe and healthy out there. This has been another episode of Not Your Average Globetrotter, and I will see you all next time. Later.